Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. Hello to my wonderful audience, many of whom tell me they listen every week to the show and get a certain amount of security and satisfaction and enlightenment from hearing me and hearing me interview good people from around the world. Before getting to my guest today, I do want to tell you that you're going to really enjoy him. You're going to feel like you've made a new friend. Like, hey, I just met this guy. We were sitting and talking, and he really cares about people, and he's doing good and positive things, interesting things, had a lot of interesting experiences. So I think you're going to enjoy today's show. Before that, however, comes the newsflash. Well, I think I have to talk today about Elliot Rodgers, the Santa Barbara shooter, slasher, hitter of people with cars. First, let me say that this is not a clear-cut psychiatric drug case. The latest that I have, at least, is that he hadn't seen a psychiatrist in 2 years, that a psychiatrist prescribed him Risperdal. He, being an intelligent young man, looked it up on the internet, and like I believe any intelligent person would do after having actually looked up the drug, he decided not to see it and didn't see his psychiatrist again. There's an important lesson from that. In his manifesto, he mentions that he might take his Xanax, his leftover Xanax and Vicodin, and make it easier to kill himself. To do it before he shot himself. However, we have no indication that he was regularly taking either of those drugs. We don't know where he would have gotten the Xanax, although obviously college student, you can get it anywhere. And the Vicodin he probably would have had from the injury he had when he confronted some students, tried to push some of them off a wall, 10-foot wall, and got pushed off and got his ankle broken. So it's not clearly a drug issue, but it's clearly a psychiatry issue. Almost every one of the shooters has been through psychiatry. Psychiatry doesn't catch these people. Surprise of surprises, anybody clever, shrewd, dishonest, and evil enough to plan, and most of these guys are planners, to plan this kind of assault on other human beings, is going to be able to fool psychiatrists. We don't have any specially good antenna sticking out of our heads to detect violence-prone people. And that just makes me want to remind people that all these calls from the left, the right, the middle, all these calls to beef up psychiatry, it doesn't work. All these guys were through psychiatry. Psychiatry, if anything, makes it worse because they do give drugs that loosen inhibitions, agitate people, drive them over the edge toward violence. And also, they humiliate people. My colleagues in their hospitals and sometimes in their offices too humiliate people with diagnoses, with involuntary treatment. And since humiliation is the major drive of all personal violence, humiliation, feeling ashamed, belittled, minimized, as this young man's manifesto shows, drives people to commit violence. Psychiatry humiliates people. It's not a solution to these problems. And indeed, if you tried to lock up every suspected violent person, you'd lock up a psychiatrist and do what they did with the state mental hospitals. They'd end up with 500,000 people locked up, and you still probably wouldn't get Elliot Rodgers or Aaron Alexis, the Navy Yard shooter, or Adam Lanza from Newtown, or James Holmes, all of whom from Aurora, all of whom were through psychiatry. So psychiatry is not the answer. Now, what is the answer? Well, this is a multi-determined violence. You have, of course, where he's living. He's living in the ultimate shallow pit in America, in Los Angeles. His father objectifies women in ways I won't describe on the radio. He's a guy who comes from a broken family. He is a person who's an outsider. He's alone. He's alienated. All the shooters virtually have this pattern, because shame is what drives violence, and shyness is simply the physical manifestation of feeling shamed and humiliated. We've got the video game. Someone pointed out to me, I have never played any of these violent video games, that at each stage you get killed and then you start over. And these shooters, many of them watching these video games, and they are killing people systematically and then shooting themselves, as in the video games. What do we do about video games in a free society? It's a serious problem. I'm not even going to give answers. It's a serious problem. We have a culture that in sports, movies, videos, honors violence. Another thing that obviously went into this man's life. Then we have the availability of guns. Some of you know I'm a Second Amendment supporter. I believe in the right to keep and bear arms. But people who agree with me are getting too excited about the fact that, well, you see, what are you going to do, ban knives, going to ban cars? I think that's a very inadequate, lacking response. This young man did use guns, and you can be sure that even though he stabbed people and even though he ran people over in his car, what gave him his courage was the possession of a gun. There's no question that guns enable people to kill people. And I say that as somebody who doesn't want to see a lot of limitations on the right to keep and bear arms. So, again, we have a very serious situation. I know I'm going a little longer than usual here, folks, but I won't go much longer with my news flash, which is turning out to be more of a news statement, similar to some of the shows that have been interviewing me on the subject. Well, what are we going to do about all this? I don't think we can do a lot about it. I think we have to approach it with caution. Concerning guns, we have much tighter controls on guns now than we did back in the earlier days of the 40s and 50s and 60s. We have much tighter gun controls throughout the country, and this stuff is escalating, and indeed he got his guns legally. Can we take away all the guns in America? Not only I don't want to, but we can't. We can't. And the other issue is that the shooters always go. I mean, they're smart enough to always go to those gun-free zones that exist in America. The Aurora shooter, James Holmes, went out of his way to go to a movie theater quite far from him because it was the nearest one that was gun-free. You couldn't bring your guns into that theater. And all the school shootings take place in gun-free zones. So we've got really complicated issues here. I'm not going to make strong suggestions other than a few no's. No, we probably can't blame drugs. Let's wait and see. No, let's not go ahead and have a lot of involuntary treatment increases in the U.S. It won't touch this problem. And finally, of course, his parents called the police. No, his therapist called the police after seeing some of his videos. The police went to see him, and he talked the police into leaving. They didn't even, and they had the power under these mental health checks to take him to the emergency room. They had the power to walk into his apartment. Once you're involved in the mental health system, you don't have our constitutional protections. And the police didn't do anything. And his therapist tried. So I mean, again, the mental health system is not going to be the solution to this problem. Okay, folks, let me take a deep breath. Matthew Morris, are you there?
I am, Peter.
Yes, you listened to my 10 minutes on this subject that I'm so open here to talk about in the media. I thought I should at least talk about it on my own show. And it's just a tough and complicated problem.
Sure.
Matthew is director of operations for Stepping Stones West in Great Britain. Yes, he's another one of my marvelous British guests. In his country would be a registered nurse with special training in mental health. He's, in Great Britain called, in their quaint way, a mental nurse. I got that right?
Yeah.
And Stepping Stones is a very interesting place. It's not part of the National Health Service. And it consists of what they call a blend of people who are professionals and trained and people who have lived experience helping the people who come in a variety of different ways, even helping them maintain homes and clean up their homes and just talking with them and just trying to provide whatever they need. Matthew's also got experience with the voice hearers. I want to talk about that. He's got an interest in hoarding because he goes to these folks' homes and boy, are they ever cluttered. Matthew Morris, welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Pick up where you would like to. You're actually familiar with the show, which I'm delighted to hear.
I am. It's very strange listening to the introduction music and waiting to come on because that introduction music for me is synonymous with my Sunday morning routine, which is to listen to your podcast while I'm doing the ironing. It's quite surreal to hear that music and then me about to come on the show. So, yes, I'm very familiar with the show.
Well, and it's a little surreal and very gratifying to me because we had no idea that you'd even heard of me, as with many of our guests that we contact. It turns out you're listening to the podcast. That's just wonderfully gratifying. And it also turns out that your life, like so many of my guests, was very much affected by Toxic Psychiatry, the book. And we don't have to go any more into that, at least right now. Tell us about your work. Start where you would like to with your work.
Well, yeah, I suppose it's interesting with my work now. I've been working in this field of trying to help people for the last 33 years, and it feels like now with Stepping Stones, it's almost come full circle, because when I started as a 16-year-old with a government scheme in Northampton, I was asked to go to a drop-in center, and they said it was for people with mental illness, and I didn't even know, I'd never heard of mental illness. I didn't know what to expect when I turned up, and I had a year there where it was about meeting people and getting to know the different characters that came in and dropped in to the center and getting to know them and how we could help, and that's what I enjoyed, and that's what I thought it was about. And it was interesting because I was aware that there would be professionals coming and going who would talk about these people that I knew in a very different way. They'd talk about them in terms of their diagnosis, so describing people as a schizophrenic or as something else. And I remember finding that very strange because it didn't seem to relate to the person that I knew. So I suppose my curiosity started then and my interest in the work started then. So I then went in to do my nurse training, and I think similarly I realized that there was a massive contradiction between what I was observing in terms of what people, how they were feeling and what they needed and how you could help on a very human level, and what I was being explained to or what the origin of their problems were and this definition of people in terms of their diagnosis. And I think I was very young, and I think I was quite shocked by the things I saw in hospital, and I don't think I was emotionally prepared altogether for those. So I think I probably disassociated a bit of way of coping, but I just knew something wasn't right, it didn't feel comfortable. So I did carry on as a nurse when I qualified. But again, I found the same thing. I worked with people over the age of 65 who were described as having a functional illness. A lot of people were being admitted for depression. And I just began to question what was happening more. It was predominantly medication and ECT for these people. And I was thinking, well, surely this isn't right. And I think two things struck me most of all. One was that I asked the psychiatrist, I said to her, how do you know that there's a chemical imbalance that's causing this depression and it's not to do with this person's life experience? And she said to me, because I know. And I knew then that she didn't know, and this was a question of belief more than knowledge. And I think the other thing that struck me at the time was also that these were a group of people who were coming to the end of their life, and never was there a discussion about those issues. It was seen purely and predominantly as a medical issue, when clearly those would be issues that people would be reflecting on as they came to the end of their life. And I think that sort of, for me, then, I didn't have any vehicle for any alternative, but I knew something wasn't right. So that led me to leave the services.
Well, go ahead. I was going to say, just keep telling us about what steps, because I think it's a very interesting story. It's not too dissimilar from my own, going into state mental hospitals at the age of 18 and just seeing with clear eyes that none of what the psychiatrist was doing made any sense at all, and certainly not how I viewed the people I was trying to help. So,
the other thing was around the diagnosis of schizophrenia, because it just didn't make any sense to me that it seemed that, and obviously evidence shows that as well, that the onset was predominantly for age between sort of 15, 16 and sort of 26, 27. And it didn't make any sense to me that an illness would strike, but also at a time when people were making that transition from childhood to adulthood, and also I'd just experienced those similar stresses and strains of making that transition from home life to independent life, and it was very difficult. And my family background had been, relatively straightforward and nurturing and caring, and if you didn't have that, then that's a tremendously difficult transition to make, and that people could be so sure this was an illness and not related to those experiences just didn't make any sense to me. But again, I didn't have any knowledge to really challenge that. And it was then, after having left the health service, I met a woman. So I was working for a charity then, and she'd just been discharged from hospital after a four-year admission. And she was really struggling with her voices, and she was terrified of going back into hospital, and her recovery had been based on coming off all her medication. It wasn't that her doctor was particularly enlightened. They just didn't know what to do with her. So it was almost like her last chance. She was either a long-stay patient, or they agreed with her wish was to come off her medication. And as a surprise to them, that was the transition for her. What she felt was that the medication always suppressed the side of her brain, which was actually her intellect and an ability to cope with the experience, but it never took away the actual voices themselves. So when she was freed up, her brain was freed up again, she could begin to see life in a different way. But having then been discharged, she was alone at home and she didn't know what to do. So she asked me for help, and I didn't know what to do either, but we made an agreement that we would try and find out together about how we could help and what we could do. And it was then someone said to me, had I looked at a book called Accepting Voices by Marius Rom and Sondra Escher. The woman I was supporting, she's much more of an academic and a reader than I. So I gave her the book first and said, well, let's read it together and let's go on then a journey of discovery, really. And that's how I got into learning about the voice healers movement and that approach. But also she taught me far more than I'd probably learned in my training about what it was to have the experience of being a patient. I think looking back on it now, she probably helped me and taught me probably more than I did her. But I was a consistent person there to work through things when times were difficult. But what we certainly learned was that very often the voices weren't the problem as such. That when it was difficult for her, life was difficult, it's because things were happening. There were things that made her feel a certain way, and there were difficult feelings for her. And often they manifested themselves through the voices. So that part of the work was by opening up the conversation to the voices and understanding them rather than trying to eradicate them and to see them as a kind of errant symptom that was meaningless. Actually, they had great meaning and were often either symbolic or a metaphor for what was happening in her life. And often, she, in the midst of it, she couldn't see that. So having an ally, having a guide there, enabled me to be able to reflect to her maybe what was happening, and also that a knowledge that it would pass. It doesn't stay this way. And we found a way of helping. And it was then we found your book, Toxic Psychiatry, and then this person joined me and some other workers in trying to spread the word, really, that there was a different way, and you could look at things differently, and you could, and it was effective, and it was far more based on things that made sense to me now, which was about being, as you talk about, being empathic, being kind, and being helpful. And I suppose that then set me on a path to try and explore that in more and to find some more evidence that would support that way of being with somebody.
Now, what setting were you working with her in?
I was in the voluntary sector then, so I was working for a charity who we set up we called it an activity centre. So we just provided space for people to come and to be active in their life. It's interesting now because we took a philosophy that people needed an opportunity to be able to start afresh. So it just wouldn't be allowed now. We'd never take a history. We'd never ask for a diagnosis. We'd never ask for treatment. We would only take the information the person wanted to share with us, because we saw that as the beginning of a two-way relationship. We never did a risk assessment. This was in the 90s, which would be unheard of here now. They'd think it was terrible not to do, but it worked. We didn't have any incidents worthy of a risk assessment because people were people and they valued that way of being with people. But that was in the voluntary sector. I did, against your advice, actually, when you came over, you said someone asked you at a conference that we organized, how can you change the system from within? And you said to them that you can't. I didn't take that advice, and I did go back into the health service thinking I could help it to change. And I was back there for 12 years working in, I was the leader of the Assertive Outreach Service.
Matthew?
Assertive Outreach. Yeah, I think it's called Assertive Community Treatment in the States. But over here, the UK model of assertive outreach was very much about engaging with people on their terms, getting alongside people, because over here it was instigated because of a number of people who disengaged with mental health services. As you were talking in the start of your show about why would anyone engage with a psychiatric system, and that what we've tried to do in the early days of assertive outreach was to say, well, it is okay because we won't make diagnosis and treatment that the be-all and end-all about the relationship. first and foremost, is how can I help you? And what we found was those people that the services found hard to engage, they weren't really hard to engage, not if you actually wanted to truly help them. So the idea was you would help them in a way that was meaningful to them. So if their flat was in a mess, you would help them clear it. I mean, I did decorating, I laid carpets, I did shopping. It's just getting alongside people. But then, from the basis of that relationship, you could begin to help them with the issues that maybe meant they kept on going into hospital. So we were able to show that that truly works. And one of the things that worked against us in the long run was compulsory treatment order. That was counterproductive. So I agree with what you said at the start, that compulsory treatment does not rectify the problems that you have in a cultural society. There's a thirst for it because people want answers and they want simple answers, but in the long run, it's counterproductive because people will look to avoid that system because it doesn't actually help. And that's what we found. And I think the evidence from the UK now on supervised community treatment orders is that they haven't been a success. There's been far more than they anticipated, but I think the evidence from Tom Burns was it would take, I'm not sure the exact figure, but it was something like it would take 35 community treatment orders to save one bed day. So as I was back in the health service, I was there for 12 years, towards the end it became more and more difficult to have a more empathic, relationship-orientated way of working with people because the push was much more to get people into hospital, get them on depot medication, and get them out on a community treatment order.
I want to underscore, we've got about 2 minutes before break, a couple of things you're saying. One is that the involuntary treatment doesn't help people. Mm. It doesn't prevent violence, which is a point I was making earlier, and it makes people want to stay away from psychiatrists with good reason. And another thing you said that was so important was that you were able to communicate with these, quote, difficult patients. Mm. What made them difficult was they probably didn't want to be told they were schizophrenic and had to take drugs. Mm. But you related to them as people. You were also very helpful to them. And that's my experience, and people that a lot of psychiatrists think are very difficult, I get along with quite easily. Mm. And some people that they think are just really perfect patients, I feel are tragic examples of people being ruined by psychiatric drugs.
I always remember the story that I think it's in Toxicopsychiatry where you talked about when you were working on a ward and a woman came in at night. And she was, I think she had kind of a feeling or hallucination that, or a sensation that were spiders on her arm, but she was very tired and very hungry. And I think in the book you talked about giving her your lunch, your packed lunch, or whatever you packed up. So you gave her some food and gave her care. And I think you stroked her arm. And very quickly she got to the point that she didn't really need to be there anymore, but almost she had to stay another couple of days because nobody would have believed that she would have got better. And that story always stayed with me, and I think because about validating people's experiences, and then that's what the Voice Healers work is very much about, is that whatever people are experiencing, it's real, and to dismiss it as a symptom is denying the person their experience. So if you engage with people with what's real to them, that's always got to be your starting place, because otherwise you're denying them themselves and their humanity. And I think that's the problem if you try to straight away go through a checklist of symptoms and then impose a diagnosis, whether or not that's right or not. There's that fundamental principle that you're not listening and not hearing the person.
You know, I like being reminded about helping that woman. What I did was she had worms, she thought, I think, coming out of her arm. And I told her I wasn't afraid of them, and I just put my hand gently on her arm. And she thought food was poison, so she hadn't eaten in a few days. So I actually, what I had to do, in those days we didn't even have canteens or anything in hospitals, psych hospitals. Some of the nurses gave me their evening milk and stuff. And I remember sitting with her, and she thought the milk might be poison, so I drank a little, and then I gave it to her, and that reassured her. Just being caring, being thoughtful, being sensitive.
Yeah.
My guest is Matthew Morris, Director of Operations for Stepping Stones West. We'll bring on the music, and when we come back, Matthew, remember to tell people how they can get in touch with you.
Yep, we'll do.
And this is Peter Breggin. I'm a psychiatrist, as most of you know. And by the way, don't forget that all the shows on PRN-FM are put in the archive, usually quite soon after the show is over. It goes in the archive, and people all over the world can listen. We are one of the favorite shows, I think, and I'm really, really pleased and always am pleased to be on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest, Matthew Morris, you probably can sense by now why I thought you would like him. Matthew, there's something that just is, so genuine and direct about how you think about things and how you've tried to manage your professional life. It's really a pleasure to get to know you. Do you want to tell folks how they can get in touch with you?
Sure, yeah. Probably best is my email. That's Matthew with two T's dot Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S, at steppingstonescommunity.com. So that's Matthew.Morris at steppingstonescommunity.com.
All right. I hope you got that. Matthew Morris at steppingstones.com.
Yep, steppingstones.
Did I get that right?
Steppingstonescommunity.com.
Steppingstonescommunity.com. The more we say it,
yeah,
the more they'll remember it, or
yeah,
I'll garble it up. There's a lot of subjects to talk about. I mean, we can talk about more about the voice series. We can talk more about therapy. We can talk more about hoarding. And we can talk about anything you want. So let's start our second hour with where you'd like to go. Second half hour.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if you like, I mean, I could tell people a bit more about the Voice Hearers network. I suppose I'd like to do that, to get that message out.
I want you to do that very much.
Sure. So people don't know, the Voice Hearers movement started in the late 80s, 87. There was a Dutch social psychiatrist called Professor Marius Rom, and he would say, and in the story is that he wasn't particularly radical, but he was a social psychiatrist, and he had a client called Patsy Hager, and she grew more and more frustrated with him because she was had the experience of voices, which he was treating in a very psychiatric way, prescribing things, seeing it as part of a diagnosis, and not acknowledging her experience. So she challenged him and said, you know, how come you believe in a God that you neither see nor hear, yet you deny my experience, which I am hearing right now? And to his credit, he took that challenge and said, well, yes, she has got a point. So he began to have conversations with her about her experience, and what he found was that the experiences not only had meaning, but the process of acknowledging the experience and listening to her experience had was having an impact on how she felt generally. So he became curious, and I think it was significant at the time. His partner was a journalist, Sandra Escher. I think she probably was influencing things at that time also to say, well, yeah, let's find out more about that. So he and Marius and Patsy went on a chat show in Holland to t- talk about what they'd done and their experience, and they invited other voice hearers to phone in. And to his surprise, I think 200 or 300 people phoned in. And that started off the origins of a resonance, they called it, the movement in Holland, of getting people together, had the experience. And he began to do some research comparing those people who heard voices and experienced that as a problem and those who had the experience and didn't consider it a problem, and to try and see what the differences were. And what the initial findings was were that the difference seemed to be much more about whether the person had a context or a story that meant that made sense to them behind the experience, and also then whether they were frightened or not of their experience. And so what that led them on to try and facilitate people with experience getting together to talk to each other. And also when they looked at the prevalence of voice hearing within, when they'd done studies of the normal population, and there'd been several in the States and other parts of the world, they found that hearing voices, I think it was something like around, usually between 3 and 6% of the normal population hear voices, which by that level means that hearing voices alone cannot be considered a symptom of an illness, because it's such a significant number of the normal population were having the same experience. So the key thing to be about how you interpreted your experience, why you were having it, so within the context. So that was the origin, and from that it blossomed. In 1997, Intervoice was formed, which is the international it's an alliance, really, of people from a professional background and people who have the experience of hearing voices. And the aim is to see it as a society issue, as you were talking at the start, that voice hearing is a normal facet of being human. It's a human capacity and capability. But to some people, we might, if we were deprived of contact, so if you go in those isolation chambers, we all have the capacity to have voices or see things that aren't there. But also life challenges can bring that experience. So extreme fear and terror, any experience that renders you powerless, can manifest itself with voices and visions. So it's more about what's happened to people rather than what's wrong with them. So the experience is always understandable within the context of someone's life. And also then it's the person's right to choose how they want to live their life. So what path they take with their voices or without their voices is then their choice. So that's what also appealed to me about the voice hearers movement, because it's not saying that it's right. What it's saying is that this is a facet of being human, and if we can accept it and allow people to talk about it, it ceases to become frightening. That many people in the movement liken it to homosexuality and other differences that throughout history has been seen within cultures and then in psychiatry as an illness, whereas it's not. It's a human variance, a human difference, which is stigmatized because of fear, and then people have the associated shame, lack of self-esteem, because they know within that society it's not tolerated. So so I would urge people, if they're interested, that the vehicle into the voice hearers movement and how the power of people's recovery through the voice hearing approach is to listen to a TED lecture by Eleanor Longden. I don't know if you've seen that, Peter. Eleanor Longden is now a doctorate. She's a clinical psychologist. She's working with Professor Reed in Liverpool, but she describes her story from being a voice hearer, diagnosed with schizophrenia, and then her recovery in a TED lecture. So if you go to the TED.com, Eleanor Longden, that's a tremendous introduction to...
I'll try to get her on the show, actually, folks. Right. So I think she'd be a wonderful person to have on the show.
She would, and I think it's a TED lecture. I think it's been viewed by 2.5 million people now worldwide. And in it, she explains the voice hearers movement, but also her own experiences and how she learned to see her voices in a new way. She recognized that they were facets of herself. And the most violent and difficult voices were the ones that required the most respect, because they were parts of her that had been the most hurt. And when she learned that, she built a new relationship with them, which she has to this day. Her voices haven't gone, but she's successful in doing what she wants to do in life because she's built a new relationship with them. She actually said when she did one of her exams for her master's, I think, that one of her voices dictated a lot of the answers. So it's amazing story. So I've been involved in that. Sorry.
Help me with this. Obviously, as a psychiatrist, I get to hear people whose voices generally are very, very painful to them. And my experience, not as vast as people who work in the voice hearers movement, is that at least the people who seek help, and that's a very special population, the people who are really feeling beleaguered and seek help, the voices are often horrendously nasty. And they're saying things that, for example, the person's abusers in childhood said to them. And then, of course, when we're abused, we learn to say terrible things to ourselves.
Yep.
So the voices were very much like their own internal voices saying mean things,
yep.
And like the voices from childhood of the abusers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the voices were terrifying to these people.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about how people come to grips with that through the voice hearers, and do folks like that actually join the movement?
Yeah, certainly. I think what I've learned through talking to voice hearers have had that experience and have made that transition. There's several ingredients that seem to be common. One is that. It's such a relief to people to hear that they're not the only one, and also that it can change. I think hope is a tremendous part of the change. I think then also it's about learning that as a person you have rights. So you have rights in relation to your relationship with your voices. So it's not actually to set up a battleground, but actually to work with the person initially about having the confidence to maybe to try out some ground rules. A lot of people, and Eleanor is one of them, is begin to set to assert some limits with the voices, to say to the voices, look, it's really difficult if you're there all day, every day, because I can't concentrate. But what you've got to say may be important, so I can give you half an hour, and this is the time when I'm going to be available to you. And I will listen, and it's important that people do it. But I think also at the same time, it's trying to think about not seeing the voices in a literal way, but sometimes in a metaphorical way. So maybe some of the things that the voices are saying can be incredibly painful, incredibly nasty, but sometimes that's because they represent a part of a person that's been damaged and hurt. I think with Eleanor's example is that one of the voices which was the most demonic and painful, I think she began to associate it more with her anger. So what had happened to her had made her so angry she hadn't been able to tolerate that level of violence. So she disassociated and switched off from it. So that was a way it was kind of seeping back in. So once she was able to acknowledge that it was part of that damaged part of her, she had a different respect for it. And I think also that in terms of setting the limits, she began to realize that she did have some power as well, that she would say that she began to realize that this voice that previously she'd been running away from in a sort of fight and flight way, when she stopped and listened and invited it, she actually realized that she could understand it. And then later she began to realize that it would sometimes wait until she was ready to talk to it. So the power balance had shifted. There's another example in the recovery story book that Maris Rom wrote with colleagues, where a voice hearer set a task for, this voice had always been threatening it would harm him or his family. And he got to the point over time to say to the voice, Well, I'll believe that if when I come down in the morning, the washing up is done. If you can do what you say you can do, then washing up would be an easy task. It's a way of shifting that kind of sense of power, but also not by doing that with conflict, but by actually acknowledging and accepting. That's why the key phrase in the first book was accepting voices, accepting they're real, accepting they're meaningful, and they're there for a reason. And then maybe once you begin to develop a new relationship, it becomes less conflictual. There's another example of a lad whose voice was very bullying, but when they actually had, with his work at Dirk Corson's, when they actually talked to the voice was very frustrated that this guy was so unassertive. So he got more and more bullying, but actually he became less and less assertive. So they were able to say to the voice, well, is what you're doing working? And so then again, it shifted the relationship and said, well, actually, no, that doesn't work. So the intention of the voice was to be helpful, but it actually got skewed and got far more bullying. So again, the key message for me to take from that is that these are meaningful experiences, which if you then understand them in the context of the individual, so it's not there's no universal meaning of voices, but it's always going to be unique to the individual. So you have to start afresh with each person you know to say, how can I learn about you? And I think that's what we take forward into our work now, is to say, I know a lot, but I know nothing about this next person I'm going to meet. So let me get to know you, because the language you use, your experiences will all be unique to you.
Matthew, let me ask a question again, because what you're saying is incredibly interesting, and I'm sure in everybody it's raising all kinds of thoughts. When I hear someone tell me they hear a voice that is threatening them and their family,
mm-hmm.
I immediately think to myself, and will probably eventually share, mm-hmm. I think to myself, well, that's exactly what a sexual abuser tells to children.
Mm-hmm.
The sexual abuser says, if you ever tell anybody about this, I'll kill you and your mother and father.
Yeah.
Or you and your family. Sure. Or if it's a parent, you and your favorite dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, would that come up in the way you work, or is that too psychological, too much coming from the therapist?
I think where I come from, yes, of course it comes up, because I think that again, because as I said, very often the voices make sense in the context of people's lives, and people who are distressed and frightened, it is often because of those experiences that they've had. And I think, again, what seems to be the most common factor, and I think Ellen is actually researching that now as a psychologist, is in terms of what are the predictors of someone that's probably going to go on to have that experience. And I think it is those experiences that render you powerless. And again, as a child, the most common of those are childhood sexual abuse, and also bullying. I think bullying is coming up very high in the research. So yes, I think what my approach often is, because it's always the person's choice about then how they want to address those things. So it's actually bringing them, understanding them, and then maybe somewhat facilitating. Someone might want to go into therapy, and I say, well, yes, I'm going to have to deal with that. But sometimes therapy is not the right time for people, and it's enough for them to know, and then later on they might decide, yeah, I'm going to go and work on that. It's very much the work that I do, and I think it's the basis of the Voice Hearers Network, is it's the individual's choice. And I think that's where I see a lot of the skilled work as a mental health professional is as a facilitator, and as a nurse also. I think when I got lost in terms of not knowing what I wanted to do, I explored other therapies and social work, and actually I found nursing that I hadn't, what I'd been doing wasn't really nursing, but the core of nursing is about easing distress and seeing the person and so how can I help, and then try to facilitate the person getting the help that makes most sense to them. Not everyone's going to want to see their voice and experience in the context of looking at those things that happened to them in the past. Some people want to draw a line under it. It's just enough to know. Some people want to go back over that time because there's issues that haven't been resolved. But I think one other thing in work which always struck me is when you have, we have to have training on child protection and safeguarding children. The scale of when they tell you the figures and the scale of abuse that's happening, then it seems just obvious that there's a correlation between that and those people that come into mental health services. So it's such a shock and a scandal that how little it's discussed and how little it's addressed and how often even the knowledge of those experiences in people's lives that, the illness process, the diagnosis, how it can override those experiences people know to have happened. I think it's part of our culture, which I think it needs to be addressed. And I think the voice healed work does that.
Yeah, I think that it's a wonderful phenomenon, the voice hearers. Very, very much so. What about the sense of the profound sense that many people have who hear voices, that they are not their own creation, that they are somehow in the spiritual universe? My experience is they don't have explanations for it. They don't elaborate theology very much, but there's a conviction that the voices are totally real and they are not their own production. And how much of that do you see, and how many people go on to manage successfully while still believing that the voices are wholly external to them?
The most honest answer, Peter, is I don't know. I think that I think it is such a unique experience that I think that there'll be the people that the people can do that, but you can kind of accommodate those beliefs within your normal day, and those people it's more of a struggle. And I think some of it is to do with a cultural, because I think there's people that have those experiences and they're accepted spiritually within their culture, so therefore it's not something to be worried about or anxious about. It can actually be something held in esteem. Whereas there's other people, if it's a different belief, then that's not held by your friends and colleagues locally, then you're seen in a different way. So some of it might be explained in terms of the context of your culture. There's many religious beliefs where, spirituality and hearing things, seeing things is acceptable. So I don't know. I don't know whether it is a cultural phenomenon to do with, or whether it's to do with people's experiences. My guess is it will be unique to each person. And probably the best people to answer that is someone that's having experience, and rather than me.
Yeah.
I think as a non-voicer, my role is to be interested and and to be, as we've said before, to be there to help if people want help and to help people make sense of it in their own way. But I know from hearing the stories and meeting the people that that's incredibly powerful. That having that, and I think Eleanor says in her TED lecture that having people alongside her as allies that enabled her to do it herself. They didn't do it for her, but they were there alongside her, knowing that it was possible that she would come back to them, and that she had those talents and abilities, and believing in her. And I think that I think for me that forms the basis of all that we do, whether it's a voice hearer or anyone, is to have that belief in somebody. And to be part of their journey, but it's their journey, and we can be kind of guides and facilitators and holders of hope sometimes. So that's one of the areas which inspires me, because for me, as I said at the start, I was looking for a path, and again, that made much more sense to me. It was a personal journey based on your life, and that the power of another person to to help with the healing was by kindness and compassion. Because that's in a way the only true knowledge that I've gained, I think, in the world of mental health. There's many theories that's unproven, and it's a question of belief very often.
We've only got about 40 seconds left, I would guess. Talk very briefly about the satisfactions of the work you're doing, because it sounds to me like you get a lot of satisfaction, as I do, from doing therapy that is outside the psychiatric model. Just speak for a few minutes about that, and we'll finish up.
I think the satisfaction is to find myself at full circle in a place now within Stepping Stones where it's kind of celebrated of just being helpful. That our sole aim is to say, how can I help you? And to know that if you understand that for all of life's problems, there's going to be an emotional feelings and psychological component. And then if we can help people to embrace that and understand that and take away some of the fear and the shame, people can achieve anything they want to achieve. But there has to be an acknowledgement that some of the things that hold you back from that are to do with how you feel. But that doesn't mean to say there's anything wrong with you. It's just getting to know you and what's happened in your life. My supervisor always tells me that every feeling is perfect because it's there for a reason. There's no hierarchy. So if you feel sad, you feel sad for a reason. So it's the perfect thing to feel. So not to be afraid of those emotions, but to embrace them and to move on.
My guest, Matthew Morris, Great Britain, Director of Operations for Stepping Stones West, who touches my heart by telling me that on the weekend he starts out in the morning listening to this show, and perhaps you'll sit and listen to us over the weekend. Matthew Morris, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Peter.